that makes me know that we had the right idea in the beginning, and we just need to maintain our focus and elevate. We update our formulas. We have certain formulas, but we update them with the times and everything, you know. And so.
Hello, my basketball friends, and welcome to the Teardrop Runners, your weekly dose of basketball analytics. Take orally as needed. The Teardrop Runners is a four-man team of basketball outsiders, and every Tuesday night we get together and try to learn a little bit more about the state of analytics in the NBA. It's sort of like one of those, you know, old French salons, only this is about something important. I'm your host, slash Walnut Scott, live from the land of pleasant living and home of the AFC East. No, the AFC champion Baltimore Ravens East. Anyway, that's me. With us as always are
MRB out in Brooklyn.
Chris Brown in Gettysburg.
And you got Big Shot here in Manhattan. What's up, fellas?
All right, welcome, guys. Did everybody have a good inaugural MLK weekend?
Oh, yeah. Awesome.
Yep, I worked. It was cool.
I had a pizza made out of delicious caramelized onions.
That's true. My wife cooked that. Yeah, we had a little inauguration brunch. Let's get down to business, guys. I've heard a lot of straw men talking out there about our show, and they're saying that NBA stats are boring. I actually agree with that, but unfortunately I checked with iTunes and all the other topics were taken, and that's why I call the first segment homework. Each week, the three of us who actually enjoy watching the NBA pick a player and follow him. It's always a him for some reason. For the week, and then come back on Tuesday with some sort of capsule analysis of that player. Sounds boring? Does it?
Nah.
Does that sound boring to you guys?
I enjoy it, actually. I'm crazy like that, though.
All right, good, because a lot of these straw men are getting on my nerves saying it's boring. Rob, if there's anyone who knows how to make homework fun, it's you. And you were following a certain nugget whose name is so fun to say, I wanted to give you the chance to say it first. Rob, what's the name of the man that you were scouting this week?
Danilo Gallinari!
All right.
Very well.
That was a perfect replica of the MSG announcer.
Thank you. Thank you. I've seen it and heard it enough live myself here. So I'll hop right in. I had Danilo Gallinari. I saw he was shooting well, and I also picked teams not as bad as Scott in previous weeks. Teams that were less exciting to watch, especially offensively. And so I chose him. And one thing I noticed about the Denver Nuggets is that they're a very balanced team. If you look at them, they're well balanced in scoring, and there's pretty much no way to predict which player will be the hottest on a given night. The reason I chose Danilo is because, like I said, they've been on a tear, and I thought a lot of it was due to his success shooting the ball.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, famously, Mike D'Antoni called him the greatest jump shooter he's ever seen while he was lying about him in New York.
Yeah, and people are starting to almost give him credit. If the Lakers weren't so bad and so poorly coached by him right now, he'd probably get more talk about that. But, don't even get me started on that, poor Lakers.
Yeah, you're right. Let's take a moment here. The poor Lakers. Can you imagine the suffering?
Yeah.
I read The Kite Runner, but I consider the Lakers story to be the greatest story of our time.
The Lakers did get Dwight Howard for a guy who can't play at all, somehow. And they still lost the trade.
Yeah, and they got worse.
Yeah.
But anyway, the media's done enough about the Lakers. So let's dive into the Nuggets here for a second. They started off a little slow. We were all very high on them in the beginning of the year. I was watching them play, and he didn't do too well in, I watched them play the Thunder, the game they lost, not the one they won last night. And he didn't play very well. He got exposed a lot when they were playing small ball, where he got stuck on Westbrook, and Westbrook flew by him.
Exposed out on the perimeter, basically.
Yeah. And there was just no, you know, I do think defensively he has gotten better. But something I looked at in terms of, stats is I was looking at, his shooting percentage, because it's gone up big time. And in their last 22 games, they're 15-7. And his average right now, his field goal percentage is 41.8. And he has shot below that 8 times in those 22 games. And in their record in those 22 games, or in those 8 games where he shot below 41%, is 1-7. And so I was wondering, I was like, maybe he's the X factor on their team that really makes them run and makes them, you know, a winning or, you know, a possible, you know, NBA or Western Conference final team. Uh-huh. And so I went through all of their losses for the last couple months, and you can tell that they really struggle when he doesn't shoot well. And I kind of found that interesting.
Right.
In their last seven losses, you know, I can go through these games. One of his better games, he was 5-for-16 against the Wizards, 3-for-10 against the Thunder when they lost, 2-for-8 against Memphis, 1-for-10 against the Clippers, 1-for-10 against the Blazers.
Wow.
The only loss.
Is he getting to the line much?
Yeah, he's getting to the line a decent amount, actually.
This is a great
much more than normal. He's shooting 5 attempts a game right now. Yeah, a little under 4.9 attempts
good.
A game. So it's very good for him. He's using his shot as a weapon. He's finally using it as more than a weapon to shoot. He's using the, you know, the pump and drive. And he can take.
So Rob, quick question. Is his shooting improved since he left New York? Is this like a career year for him, or is this sort of par for the course? He's very good in New York too. So I mean, I'm just kind of wondering if you can put what he's doing right now in context.
Right now he's shooting 36% from three. 2 years ago, his first year in Denver, he shot 37%. And the best he shot, New York, he shot, let's see, he shot 38%, 35%, and 34.7%. So he's kind of right around where he was. His field goal percentage has been pretty much dead on 41 every year, except the year where he got the fewest minutes. He was 44% his first year in the league.
Yeah, his effective field goal percentage, you know, I think his rookie season he was a little bit of a breakout player in the limited minutes he played. Since then, his effective field goal percentage is hovering just under 500, while his true shooting percentage has been slowly declining from 621 his rookie season down to 549 this season.
So just another question is that his plus minus is actually very, very excellent this year. So he's actually on the season, I think, plus 8. The thing that's striking, though, is that he's actually got a much better plus-minus than Iguodala does. And I really thought that Iguodala was going to be the leader of the team. Do you have any explanation, really, for how...
Yeah, I think...
You know, how that difference between...
I think this is kind of what I was saying in terms of balance. Like, my favorite thing about watching Denver is they really are so balanced. It's not just Iggy, though. Fareed is a beast down there. Ty Lawson is incredible. He's the fastest guy in the NBA, maybe. Corey Brewer coming off the bench, man, I can't say enough about him, especially because he's turned into an offensive weapon now, which is crazy.
Yes.
Florida, they were like, he's going to be a great, you know, seventh guy. He'll play good defense. He'll come out, you know, he'll be that kind of...
Chris, what were you saying about Corey Brewer?
I was just going to fill in a little bit. So I actually have the plus minus numbers in front of me. I could, you know, kind of put that, you know, statistic in there into the mix and just kind of hear what you have to say. But Iguodala is plus 7.4 on the season. Gallinari's 8.1. Kufos actually is the best on the team at 12.1. Andre Miller's plus 4.5. JaVale McGee's minus 5. Fareed is minus 1.4. Brewer is minus 3.2. Lawson is minus 2.7. Mm-hmm. So really, if you just look just at straight plus minus, the guys that are leading the team in this order are Kufos, Gallinari, then Iguodala.
And the fact that Ty Lawson's at the bottom of that list is another argument against plus minus, because he's hurt them in some of the games this season, but you know, he is the engine of that team. You know, Fareed's the manimal, but Ty Lawson really is the engine. And it's when he's having a tough game, they suffer, and they've played a lot of tough games this season. But, I mean, there's no way Ty Lawson's in the bottom 10 players on
that
team.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you there. I mean, just one point, though, is that Andre Miller does it again. This guy is just like the ageless wonder. You know, he is,
you know,
basically they substitute out for each other a lot. And so Andre Miller could be playing quite well and just kind of basically forcing Ty Lawson into negative plus-minus territory due to his great play as a substitute for Ty. If we had adjusted plus-minus, we'd have a little more insight, but that's kind of... This is what we have, unfortunately.
I think Andre Miller is the first plaque on the wall.
What's that?
What's that, Menzo?
Oh, I was just saying Andre Miller should be the first plaque on the wall of the Hall of Pretty Kind of Good for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Are you talking about the Basketball Jones, the Hall of the Very Good?
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's a Rob Nyer invention, but yeah.
Okay, I see. So sorry, Rob. You were back on the Danilo Gallinari train.
Something that like I want to argue kind of against the plus minus with Chris is, yes, Danilo is number one, and I do think after looking through a lot of their stats and games, and after watching that he is the most important player on their team, I really do think that. You know, Kupos, you said his plus minus is great. If you look at his stats on all the games that they lost, he was 6-for-6, 8-for-8, 6-for-9. 4-for-4, like he's making every shot. And yeah, he's shooting 60% overall this season. But, you know, if he's having a really good game and they're still losing, like that's obviously, in my mind, a red flag. So, you know, a lot of his...
Well, that was Kupos, or Dinlin?
Kupos is also a terrible free throw shooter, which is part of the problem with... It's like, you know, George Karl's cursed with three very talented big men who all have glaring problems with their game.
Is Fareed that bad at shooting free throws, or who are you talking besides McGee and Kupos?
I'm talking about Fareed, too. I think he gets taken advantage of on defense a fair amount, especially when they force him to center.
Okay.
So, I mean, what I'm seeing plus-minus-wise is that Kupos is outproduced, like you say. So, whoever his counterpart is outscores him by about half point a game. But his plus-minus numbers are very good. They're he's plus 12 on the year.
It's JaVale, by the way.
Is JaVale?
Yeah, for the most part.
JaVale.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that JaVale, while a very entertaining player to watch, you know, still has things to learn about positioning and just the small nuances of the center position. Kupos might be basically getting a component of his plus-minus for subbing for JaVale. Kupos also might be getting a component of his plus-minus from playing with a good starting lineup. Kupos also might be a pretty good defender. So, I mean, I don't actually have an explanation for his statistic. I'd have to watch him a little bit more closely. But those are just things to think about watching him, you know, for the rest of the year.
Heading back over to Gallinari, something I noticed, like, yeah, he's been exposed on defense at times when they're playing small ball. Like I said, there were, I think, two or three times where Westbrook just blew by him. It was like, it looked like Usain Bolt and me trying to guard him, except he didn't need the basketball. It was bad. It was really bad. But I did notice that he played some...
Why would he guard Westbrook, though?
There are just times in, well, he'll be playing the two sometimes, and he would be on it.
Well, he gets switched in the pick and roll, all types of
things. Yeah, it happens, transition, and on the pick and roll, but...
Denver switches a lot.
Oh, that is true. They actually do switch all the time. He was assigned... They also, especially when they're playing OKC, they're basically all taking turns guarding Durant. Saw the game they lost. I actually only saw parts of the game that they won. He actually did a really decent job on Durant. He kind of got him rattled a little bit. The game they won, he was right up on him. He was kind of getting in his head, and you know he got by him a little bit. But with Durant, it's not about stopping him; it's about containing him. And I thought that for the most part, he did that, especially in the fourth quarter of what I saw in the game that they won last night. And over these are my thoughts after watching Danilo Gallinari and after looking at all the stats of the games that they've won and lost. I really think he is the most important player on their team, not by a long shot. The thing I like about Denver is they're so balanced, you know, between everybody. But I think what's going to make them, if they have any chance of getting to the conference finals, you know, they've got OKC, they've got Memphis, they've got the Spurs. We all know there's teams there that are not going to be easy. But if they're going to get to the finals, I think it goes straight through the success of Danilo Gallinari.
Yeah, that's well. They certainly invested a lot of time in him. He's signed through 2016, making a little less than 10 this year, and making about 11.5 at the end of that contract. So you're certainly right that. They're going to need something out of him. If it's not going to be three-pointers, it might be something in trade. It seems like they need to build around him.
Yeah, I like him. That's a good contract moving forward, I think. Yeah. You know, it's heartening to see that statistic, that kind of steady production, too. You know, this is something that they, you know, you can never bank on a player, but the fact that he's been kind of this good for as long as he's been, that's got to make Denver fans feel good.
And I think, you know, he really is, you know, aside from some of his early shine, he really hasn't fallen off as much as sort of the general narrative would lead you to believe. You know, you would think he just forgot how to shoot because he was in a little bit of slump at the beginning of the season. The reality is he's been steady, so he's an interesting player. He doesn't seem like he's asked to rebound a lot. Is that accurate, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, he's also, I would say that would be the biggest weakness in his game. He's not a great
But it doesn't even seem like something he's asked to do.
No, no, He likes to get out there in transition. He likes to spot up right away. So, especially defensively, no, he's not, and he doesn't crash the boards too frequently, from what I've seen.
On this Denver Nuggets team, he's really asked his most important role is spacing the floor. He's really probably one of their more consistent 3-point threats, and so that oftentimes, at least on the offensive end, is going to take him out of rebounding position.
Yeah, I mean certainly on offense, but
yeah.
Defensively, he is a guy who kind of occasionally plays the two in a power forward's body.
So, yeah.
You know, you'd think you'd see him defensively at least kind of rebound at maybe a league average rate.
So here's my question for you guys before we move on from Danilo. What do you guys think with my assessment? Do you think that he is a guy that is, you know, when I say he's the X factor to them, do you think that's true? Or do you think, you know, it just takes any given day, you know, if Lawson and Iggy break out, you know, do you think they can still play well with Danilo having an off?
I think they can still play well with Danilo having an off game. But I think that to be a constant threat, his 3-point game needs to be something that can break them out of in a series. You know, if he needs to be able to do that once a series where he has a lights out 3-point performance, I think. So, I don't know. And I think he can do that, especially with the depth that Denver has. It just, you know, you really do. I think if you're a Nuggets fan, you're just hoping. He's definitely part of your prayers at night.
I mean, I think that, you know, you identify him as being one of the most important players on the team, and I agree with that. I mean, that shows up statistically. My two cents is that as somebody that spent the last 4 years in New York, you know, I was very conscious of what he did when he was with the Knicks, and then when he left the Knicks, I kind of forgot about him or didn't see him on TV as much. And I didn't quite know how important of a role he played in Denver. And so, you know, just looking at the numbers now, I realize, oh, gosh, he's still very, very good.
What's his usage rate? Do we know?
We do know.
Let me look here. Usage rate is 22% this season, which is a career high for him.
That's not a super, super high usage rate. But, I mean, his efficiency is so good that – I think that that's totally acceptable.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break from our homework for a little while. That was some awesome in-depth discussion, guys. We're going to transition before we continue on with our homework. Manziel's going to talk a little bit about a term that he introduced me to called the vampire rebound. At first, I thought it was just a ploy to get teenage listeners, but apparently it's a legit thing. Manziel, what's this all about?
So vampire rebounds, I did just make up that term, but it's something that came up on True Hoop very recently in an article by Neil Payne. Basically, he was looking at guys who have high rebounding numbers, but he didn't know were really helping their team rebound the ball. You know, so obviously, as you watch basketball,
that was an insider article, not a True Hoop article.
My mistake. You know, you'll see two guys from the same team fight for the same rebound, or you'll see no team. Or one team won't try to even get the rebound. They won't contest the rebound, and somebody has to pick it up. Those are what I'm talking about when I say vampire rebounds. They're the rebounds that are basically free to your team, and they just have to be assigned to somebody. So
so you're sucking the rebound blood out of your teammates.
Yeah. You're certainly not pumping the blood into the team.
Got it. Something's not flowing.
Yeah, so...
So are they good or are they bad?
That's such a good question. Are they good or are they bad? Manziel,
if it's not helping the team, you could say it's probably actually pretty neutral. It could be bad. If you're thinking about a guy, and let's say you're the Miami Heat, and you have poor rebounding numbers, and you're looking for a guy to add to your team to increase those rebounding numbers, it could be bad because it could make you misevaluate a player's actual skill. Mm. That would happen because right now, the stats that we have for rebounding are better than they used to be, but they're not that great. I don't know if you guys remember about a month ago or maybe 2 weeks ago, Chris Bosh came out and said he was doing some sort of special tracking of his rebounds.
It turned out
he was just counting them.
Which he then immediately stopped doing. Like 3 days later in a press conference, he said, I don't know, I don't keep track of those numbers.
Yeah.
So he for many years, I take it, did not know how many rebounds he got. And then all of a sudden, for about a week, he knew. And then now he doesn't know again.
Well, it was almost as if he didn't even know it was a stat.
Okay, yeah.
You guys ever see that Chris Bosh commercial to make the All-Star team 5 years ago?
Oh, Toronto days? Wasn't it like a used car commercial?
Yeah.
Was that the
like
setup?
$20? No, ma'am. $10? No, sir. $5? Don't think so. Vote for me for $0 for the 2009 All-Star Team. It was great.
He did this in Toronto.
Yeah, and he's dressed all country, and he's got his shooters at his side. It's amazing. He's got a cowboy hat on. Yeah. It's fantastic. Everybody should look that up.
Yeah. And we will.
Yeah. So, you know, as you can tell, when the players are talking about rebounds as if it's a brand new concept to them as a stat, then that tells you kind of where we're at in terms of analyzing rebounds in an advanced statistical way.
I'm not sure that you can take Chris Bosh as the gauge of the average NBA player. I really don't think so. Dwight Howard was waving his stat sheet around the locker room last night.
Was he really?
Yeah.
Yeah, after the loss. He's only 5 field goal attempts.
Are you serious?
Like, that's new for Dwight Howard.
That's the report.
Should,
So sorry, Manziel. We've been interrupting the crap out of you.
Yeah. So anyway, so where we're at right now in terms of rebounds, obviously those basic rebounds, this is the stat that is still very popular.
Right.
There is rebounds per 36 minutes, which is a little better. It corrects for how much a guy plays. And now in the last couple of years, we're starting to hear offensive and defensive rebound rate. This is like the percentage of loose balls that get rebounded by a player when they're on the
court. Just by player, not by team?
They do it by team as well, but they also break it out by player. So obviously, of all shots, there's 10 players on the court, so a league average rebounder is pulling in 10% of rebounds. Hmm. But as we know, those aren't really distributed randomly. So looking at Danilo, his overall rebound rate for this season is 9%.
Hmm.
So he's getting, you know, less than kind of random chance level rebounds.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually pretty common among that type of player, you know, the wing player who defends a lot of perimeter-oriented players will be rebounding around that level. The very, very top guys, the Dennis Rodmans of the world, they're clocking in just under 30% overall rebounding rate.
Yeah. Who's top this season?
Well, it's overall, it's Reggie Evans this year. He's at 24%, 24.2, followed by Varejao.
Poor Varejao, by the way.
J.J. Hickson.
I know. Yeah. What a bummer.
Yeah, he was leading the league in offensive rebound rate, second defensive rebound rate. Those are the top guys this year. But one of the other ways that we can analyze rebounds is to look at how well a team rebounds when a particular player is on or off the court. And that's how Neil Payne did it.
Is it basically a plus-minus rebounds?
Exactly.
And an averaged out for pace?
It is. Let me double-check this. I believe it is per possession because it's a rebound rate.
Well, plus minus is pace independent, right?
No, I know. I'm analogizing here. So this is sort of the rebounding version of plus minus. I'm asking.
Yeah.
So for example, the Denver Nuggets, when Danilo Gallinari is on the floor, are out rebounding their opponents by 4.9% when he's on the floor. When he's not on the floor, they're out rebounding their opponents by 2.3%. So you kind of assign that 2.6% difference to Gallinari. So they rebound better when he's on the floor. He's a plus 2.6 player when it comes to rebounding percentage.
I like it.
What he found, though, is that some of these top rebounders, so J.J. Hickson, who is third overall in the league at 21.4% in his rebound rate, he's in the opposite scenario. The Blazers, they're getting out-rebounded when he's on the court. It's pretty close, but it's negative 0.7%.
Hmm.
And they're basically dead even when he's off the court. So they actually rebound worse when J.J. Hickson, elite rebounder, is on the court than when he's off the court.
Now, who subs for Hickson?
It can be a few guys. It's that British guy, Freeland, Myers-Leonard for a lot of the year, who is a horrible
player. Myers-Leonard, a teardrop runner's favorite.
Yeah.
That's right.
But Manziel, you've seen some Blazer games, though, and so have I. Don't you think that he's a good rebounder, though?
I do think he's a good rebounder, and I think he's actually especially good at coming up with kind of the unlikely rebounds. So, you know, offensive rebounds, those rebounds where he's getting in there and really battling out with someone else, you know, in a contested rebound scenario. So, you know, I see him and I think there's a guy who I want to rebound the ball. But, you know, the numbers, on the other hand, show that you know, the team does better when you get these random dudes in this place. Jared Jeffries, he's the third guy that subs in for him. So none of those guys are big, massive bodies and rim protector types that you expect to get a lot of rebounds.
Is Hickson's a starter, though, right?
That's right.
So, I mean, I'm wondering if, like, the Blazers in general are not a very tall team.
No.
You know, and they got, I mean, Lillard's kind of a real small guy. I mean, basically, I think Batum would, I'd suspect that he'd rebound well for his position. But just my thought is that...
Aldridge is an above-average size 4. He's a big guy.
Yeah, you're right. I don't know. Aldridge's so, I don't know. My theory I was going for, and I guess probably it's not correct, was that maybe Hixon is actually playing with a bunch of midgets that can't rebound very well. And that even though Hixon is boarding pretty hard, he can't make up for, like, all the...
How many midgets are in the NBA, Chris?
Yeah.
Well, you know... Relative midgets? I mean, Lillard's kind of diminutive, right? I mean,
he's actually a legit 6'3". I thought they were giving him a few extra inches. I was wrong. I saw him standing next to somebody who I knew was about 6'1", 6'2", and he was taller than him. But anyways.
He's a skinny 6'3", though. I mean, they could just blow him into other they could blow him
for those of you listeners, 6'3", right? Is taller than all four of us. Oh, wait, Scott, how tall are you?
Yeah.
Look, I get there on my tippy toes. But let's talk about some other guys besides J.J. Hixon, because as fascinating as he is to you, most people don't give a crap about J.J. Hixon. The article also brought up a few other kind of more glamorous names. Omer Asik, DeMarcus Cousins, Al Jefferson, and, of course, Dwight Howard, all as being sort of overrated rebounders. Menzel, can you walk us through the case for those?
Sure. You know, Omer Asik is a guy whose NBA credentials are based almost exclusively off rebounds. And this season, actually, you know, he is plus 6.2 when he's on the court.
Is that right? You think it's exclusively off rebounds? I guess I didn't feel that way. I thought he was just a very solid overall defender.
Sure. Yeah. That's a better description, you know, but he's certainly not a dynamic offensive player.
Yeah, true.
He's getting there.
That's a new thing.
Yeah, it is.
So what's a Seek, though, plus-minus rebounding-wise on the year?
Yeah, he's plus 6.2%. So they're out-rebounding teams, both on the offensive and defensive glass, when he's on the court, and they're getting out-rebounded when he's off the court by about the same margin, which is about 3% overall.
But nevertheless, the article says, Asik is putting up impressive individual numbers, posting a gaudy 21.4% rebound percentage, but it's hardly made any difference in the Rockets' bottom line because, he says, they're barely rebounding at an above-average rate when he's on the floor. But what you're saying is that, okay, that's true. And Damon, our good friend Damon, friend of the show, was talking to me about this earlier, and he said, but what they don't tell you is that they're rebounding at a much lower rate when he's off the floor. So, yeah, they're not an elite team now, but he's certainly an improvement over the alternative and a pretty dramatic one.
That, I mean, you know, that makes sense scouting-wise because what you see with Houston is that he really is the only guy that is playing close to the basket. Oftentimes on the offensive end, the other four players are really spreading the floor and standing out near the three-point line. So
right, they're still not a great rebounding team.
They won't be with that offensive style they play. Right. They're really hoping that they take that three and it goes down. If it doesn't go down, then who knows what happens.
They're hoping he gets it. Yeah, or exactly. That bounces out far enough to them.
Chris, what you're bringing up is kind of what I think of, you know, where to go next to try to get better rebounding numbers that show that the guys that we see as good rebounders turn out in the numbers to be good rebounders. And that's basically tactics. So what these numbers don't tell you is that is a guy, you know, trying to rebound solo and the other four guys are running the other way, or is a team sending two or three guys to the glass? You know, so when I'm thinking about this, I'm trying to consider maybe the entire rebounding kind of system, you know, so what are the sacrifices and gains you make by sending guys to the boards versus sending those guys back on defense and vice versa.
Well, you know, for an example, you know, we were talking about Danilo's relatively low rebounding rate earlier, but I don't think you'd meet any scout in the NBA that wouldn't tell you that offensive rebounding is a huge priority for the Nuggets. So sure, you know, he's not a natural rebounder and he's not being asked to do it. But the rest of the team's rebounding, so, you know, maybe is his low rebound rate because he's given up rebounds that he doesn't need to get from JaVale or Kostakoufos or whoever.
Or the Manimal.
Or is he just not a rebounder? It's an interesting question.
Well, you know, we can look at him through his career.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he came into the league, he played, you know, anywhere between the 2 and the 4. So,
right.
You know, in the D'Antoni small ball system where he'd probably be rebounding a little more than he is with George Karl.
Yeah.
You know, so I see his rookie year, he was plus 0.9, which is, you know, basically kind of a wash. Let's see.
I mean,
his sophomore year.
I just sort of have two thoughts. One is that on a team like Houston, the guy, the one guy that's assigned to corral all the rebounds, so Asik in this case, he's gonna have a lot of opportunities to get boards, so he's gonna get actual rebounds, and then
he's also gonna miss some.
He's gonna miss some. That's normal, but you know he's gonna both show up well as a rebounder because he's one of the few guys that's playing close to the basket on that team at all times. His teammates, on the other hand, are probably going to get fewer opportunities to board than they would otherwise if they're playing on a team that wasn't built around basically outside shooting. Right. So, for example, whoever's playing the four on that team is playing kind of a stretch four role. If they were playing in a different offense and they weren't maybe called on to shoot outside as much, they would be able to secure more rebounds.
So a question I have for everybody then is, can we see that somehow in the numbers?
You'd have to have that player change teams or change offenses. So unfortunately, no.
It seems very difficult to do with any precision at all.
Do you think we could maybe infer something from perhaps like the rate of loose ball fouls? If Asik is the only guy in Houston, let's say he makes up 90% of the loose ball fouls, you know, that indicate to me that he's probably the only guy fighting for rebounds with the opposition. Versus a team where those loose ball fouls are spread around, that might indicate that there's more guys down there.
I kind of like that idea. You know, it seems to me like to be a worthwhile thing to think about. But I worry that in the case of a foul, you know, it's just a noisy statistic. You can get a foul for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that it's going to correlate very strongly with rebounding.
Well, let's talk about one other guy from this list of potentially overrated rebounders. I'm not going to mention Al Jefferson right now, and I'm not going to get into the Lakers, because I don't want to talk about the Lakers. Yeah. I want to talk about DeMarcus Cousins of the Seattle Supersonics. Wait, hold on. I'm sorry, I misread that. This says the Sacramento Kings. I don't know who that is. You know, he's a guy who, as I've said before, I think he's a good rebounder. He obviously gets a lot of boards per night, but this article points out that Sacramento has a negative 3.2 net rebounding percentage with Cousins on the floor. Menzel, well, what does that tell you about DeMarcus Cousins' value as a rebounder for the Kings? The Kings.
They're getting out-rebounded just as much when he's off the floor for this season.
Mm-hmm.
So that tells me that he is exactly average within the Kings' overall rebounding scheme.
I agree. You know,
he's
and
not
he says that
them rebound,
he's...
but.
He claims that he has one of the biggest differentials versus his teammates, but from my mind, he and Jason Thompson are the two major rebounders on that team. And right now, DeMarcus's true rebound percentage is 18.7, and Jason Thompson's is 13.8. So, you know, it's not that different. DeMarcus gets more, for sure, but Jason Thompson's still getting a fair amount. It's an interesting topic to talk about what it is that the rebounds really mean and how we can get at a more accurate sense of what's a good rebounder, and furthermore, how much does that matter to a team? Obviously, somebody's got to get the rebounds. Menzel, any closing thoughts on that before we get back to homework?
Yep.
Awesome.
Sweet. Radical. Great.
Love
closing thoughts.
Closing thoughts. That was deep.
Oh man, yeah.
Sorry.
All right, well now it's time for the return of homework. The guy I'm scouting this week is arguably the guy that replaced Monte Ellis, and that's Klay Thompson. So, you know, one of the obvious improvements that the Golden State Warriors made this week, this year, was in their defensive rating. Their defensive rating last year was 109.1. That's 100. The opponent scoring 109.1 points per 100 possessions. That was 27th in the league. This season, they're up to 13th in the league at 104.9.
Yeah.
When I watch the games, I actually think that Klay Thompson, while not necessarily an elite defender, is a really disciplined defender. But I'm wondering if you think it was actually a defensive upgrade from Thompson to Ellis, or if you think that's more a product of Mark Jackson's system.
So, I mean, when When I looked at it, I thought that, like you, I thought that basically Klay Thompson had a better size for the two-guard position and would probably defend better there. But the numbers are show that they're roughly equivalent.
And what last numbers year, are we looking at?
I'm looking at plus-minus numbers for those guys on a team. So they're pretty comparable. I mean, Monte Ellis was plus 0.2. Klay was minus 1.7. And that means that they're basically the same. So given that Klay was a rookie, I'm sure that he's improved on his defense this year. Most likely Klay's better than Monte. But still, I'm going to defend Monte's defense a little bit. Mm-hmm. He's really playing out of position in my view. He's an undersized two guard. Really, he should be playing the point.
Right.
So just because of the fact that he's been paired with Brandon Jennings at the book and the with the Bucks, and then also Steph Curry at Golden State, you know, those guys are smaller and weaker. He had to play the two when he was paired with them.
Right, right. Well, so I was watching Klay Thompson this week, the guy that replaced Monte Ellis, and, you know, obviously there's been a lot of talk about Klay Thompson. He's been sort of one of the rising stars, someone that, you know, that the people in Oakland, apparently, I don't know if this is a real thing, they call them the Splash Brothers. Are you familiar with this? I'm not happy with this. I'm not happy. I do not like to hear Jose Canseco and Mark McGuire invoked during my basketball year. Anyway, so apparently they call these guys the Splash Brothers because, obviously, they both have wet jumpers, and they're always splashing the bottom of the net. You know, Klay Thompson is an excellent spot-up shooter. And that's really, in some ways, all he has to do on this team. He could be just a spot-up shooter and work on that full-time, and I think he would be of value to the team. So, for instance, hold on, I'm looking at his... Sorry, I had Monte Ellis pulled up here because we were talking
crazy,
about him.
Crazy talk. Why would you think that?
We're going back to Klay Thompson here. And, you know, he is not as good as Steph Curry. But he's still a very good three-point shooter.
That's an incredible analysis stat. Klay Thompson.
He's shooting 40% from corner threes and 38% above the break. And between those two, those constitute close to 50% of his attempts. And when he gets a little space, he's just deadly from all those spots. Yeah. He can shoot from the corner. He can shoot above the three. But I think with him, you're also getting a really good defender. I'm not sure how it shows up in these stats. I'll give you an example. I was watching the Golden State Clippers game from yesterday. Any of you guys have a chance to catch that game?
I didn't watch it.
Saw some of it, just highlights mostly, actually.
Clippers-Warriors games are becoming must-see because, especially in Oakland, there's real animosity between the teams and the fans. It's a lot of fun to watch.
Did you see that move Steph Curry put on Chris Paul?
Yeah.
No, what happened?
That was in his defense, Chris Paul really was pretty clearly injured during that game. He hurt himself on one of his trick timeout calls where the only time Chris Paul dribbles quickly up the court is when he's going to call a timeout. And so he ran it up the court right towards the bench. Vinny's obviously telling him to call a timeout. And he looks and sees that half the Warriors have kind of turned, and he just goes straight for the basket. Harrison Barnes clipped him, and I don't think his knee was the same for the rest of the game.
Ooh, that's not good.
But anyway, back to Klay Thompson. The point I was making, there was a point early on in the game before Chris Paul hurt his leg when he still had all of his Chris Paul ISO arsenal moves. And he was in an ISO with Klay Thompson guarding him. And look, Klay Thompson is not a lockdown defender. He's not going to crush Chris Paul. But what he did was he just used excellent footwork. From the time they were out on the arc, he had his hand in Chris Paul's face. He makes good use of his hands and feet. He stays on the right side of his player. And he funneled Chris Paul right where he wanted him, which was right into David Lee for the block.
Yeah.
You know, that's the kind of stuff that I really want to see if I'm a fan of a team and a player as he's up and coming. It's to see him making those shots on offense, but also being able to kind of just do his job well on defense. And in my opinion, he's a better one-on-one defender than Steph.
When you say funneling him one-on-one towards David Lee, I get the impression that that's almost like he went by Klay Thompson. And knowing Chris Paul as a passer, he's good and I think is able to get that ball off to the big man who David Lee is supposed to be guarding. Am I wrong there?
In that case, I think you are. So in that case, the play I'm talking about, Klay Thompson stuck with him. Chris Paul got around him. Klay Thompson stuck with him and essentially sandwiched him between himself and David Lee. So he was going for the bucket on that.
I really do enjoy watching all these various cross matches when you see, you know, a 2-3 type player matching up with the opponent's point guard. There seems to be about 5 or 6 guys in a league. Yeah.
Yeah, it is a lot of fun. Iguodala is another example of that. The other thing I love about Klay from a scouting perspective is he's not great once he has the ball at getting open, and they don't run a lot of ISOs for him. And I wouldn't even call some of what they do screens, but they do something that's a little rare in the NBA, which is they make a fake cut. So both he and Steph Curry, when they're trying to get the ball in the wings, instead of just cutting to one spot or the other, they'll make a cut out and then back in or vice versa. And, you know, it works a surprising amount of the time. All he needs is a little bit of space. He's sort of trained himself to run with his hands half up, ready to catch the ball. So, he's been pretty spectacular. I think that as a shooter, he's still coming along. Those stats I quoted are not amazing, and especially when you compare him to Steph Curry's. But there's a reason I think that Golden State Warrior fans are excited about this pairing, and I'm looking forward to what they do.
As am I.
Sweet. No questions on.
I have a Klay Thompson
Mr.
question.
Mr. Thompson.
My feeling when he came into the league.
Now is the time to ask.
You know, he was kind of intended to be a one-dimensional spot-up shooter. You know, he was a guy drafted for one skill. And I think that's what he did last year, and this year he's doing something very different, or at least he's expanding his game quite a bit. And I'm wondering, like, when you watch him play, what types of things do you see him doing in the future when his game is kind of fully matured?
Well, I still think his best skill is going to be as a spot-up shooter, a catch-and-shoot guy. He's great at that. He's just got a real buttery three-point shot.
He's getting more minutes. So, like, when he's playing more, more people are seeing how effective he is as a shooter. And so when he's getting that, he's even getting ball fakes, and they'll even take a dribble and take a shot right away. I mean, you know, people know he's deadly. So he's on people's radar now. Like, last year he wasn't on anybody's radar in terms of, you know, when they're watching any film or when they need to, you know, scouting and stuff like that. He's not incredibly when he drives to the basket, and he doesn't do it that often from what I've seen. But
he's more, but he is really good in the pick and roll, and he's not a guy that goes to the basket a ton. But his mid-range jumper is so good, you know, he's scoring on 30% of his buckets are coming off of being the ball handler in a pick and roll, and he's shooting about 40% on those. You know, I think that's a pretty good number. So I guess to answer your question, Manziel, he's more than a spot-up shooter. He can do, you know, he can run kind of S cuts, and they do kind of double screens on that team. But really, he's just a great shooter.
All right.
And he's also a disciplined player. I can see him having a long career.
What do you see him kind of getting contract-wise in the future?
That's an interesting question, because I think you'll hear a lot of people as he comes up for his, the end of his rookie contract. I think you'll hear people saying that he was essentially lucky, or that he, lucked into playing next to Steph Curry. And certainly playing next to Steph Curry is great. And playing with the new David Lee is great.
Yeah.
But, he's shooting 407 from the field this season. His effective field goal percentage is 503. And his true shooting percentage is 532. So those are all encouraging numbers for, again, this is a second-year player and someone who's starting and contributing every night. And in some cases, you know, he's got nights where he's kind of carrying the team a little bit.
Yeah.
Scott,
yeah.
Can you describe to our listeners what effective field goal percentage is?
I would love to describe to our listeners what effective field goal percentage is. Unfortunately, I'm not the mathematician. Let's actually get into that, okay? I apologize. We're throwing out these numbers, and we haven't talked about them, talked about what they mean. We're not experts.
See what I did there?
What's that? You did. You did a nice transition. You lost credit by then coming back and calling attention to it, thereby bringing the transition to a screeching halt.
Yeah. Look, hot transitions. Hot trannies, guys. Love it.
Hot trannies.
Hot trannies, tight buttholes.
We do not endorse the use of the word trannies on this show. Anyway, look, we're trying to figure this stuff out as we go. And so every week we like to kind of go through a couple of stats and talk about what they mean and how they're used, what they measure, and what their shortcomings are. So you've heard us throw around in this podcast a couple of those, effective field goal percentage and true shooting percentage. Now, as I said, I'm not a mathematician, but we do have a couple guys here that work with numbers. Chris, could you give us a kind of breakdown of what effective field goal percentage is and what true shooting percentage is?
Sure. Effective field goal percentage is normal field goal percentage, except that they add an extra half point for three-pointers. So it basically gives a bonus to made three-point shots.
Okay. So it's a field goal plus
0.5 times three-pointer divided by total field
which
goal attempts.
Which makes sense, because 2 times 0.5 is 1, and 2 plus 1 is 3, which is the amount of points you get when you make a three-pointer.
Ooh.
Right. And in the basketball reference glossary, which is what I have to use for this stuff, they make a good example of why that's the case. So it says, player A goes 4 for 10 with 2 three-pointers, while player B goes 5 for 10 with no three-pointers. Obviously, player A has a lower field goal percentage, but the players would each have 10 points from field goals and would have the same effective field goal percentage of 50%.
There it is.
True shooting percentage is similar to effective field goal percentage, except that it also accounts for made free throws, or actually free throw attempts. Excuse me.
Okay. So true shooting percentage, it uses that word true as a way of sort of saying that we're extending what we're counting as shooting and including the fact that field goal percentage is relevant to a guy's scoring and the quality of his shooting.
Yep.
Yeah, right?
Correct.
So, you know, I grew up, I'm old. I'm in my mid to late 30s to 60s, and I grew up on field goal percentage, and that stat made plenty of sense to me. It's the number of shots that a guy took that he made. So, Manziel, what's wrong with just using that?
Nothing's wrong with using that on its own. These other numbers will give you a better idea of either the efficiency that a guy's shooting at or the offensive production you can expect from a guy when he's taking shots. So the raw number really actually probably should just go away in favor of EFG, you know, because it's very easy to calculate and it totally accounts for the actual act of shooting the ball. And then if you really want to find out,
okay,
you know, what the guy's impact on your bottom line scoring, then you'd want to look more at true shooting percentage.
Okay. So I'm looking at the league leaders for this season in the three categories. And the lead leader in field goal percentage, effective field goal percentage, and true shooting percentage is the same. And I think you all know who it is. Rob?
I don't know.
That's right. It's Tyson Chandler.
I knew that.
You said Tyson Chandler, right, Rob?
Tyson Chandler.
It sounded like I don't know the way it came through my mic.
Yeah, there's something wrong over here.
So, Manziel, the top guy is leading in all three categories. What difference does this distinction make?
Well, in this case, Tyson Chandler is a guy who takes almost exclusively two-point shots, except for in last-second scenarios, and is not a good free-throw shooter. So you're not going to see very many differences. The one thing he does have going in his favor is that he's only taking very makeable shots. So it's not...
Mm-hmm. Well, makeable if you're 7'2" and can jump through the roof.
Yeah, but, you know, they're makeable for him, so that's what matters.
Yeah, agree.
You know, but it's not surprising, because he's taking that concept of some efficient shots to its logical extreme.
So, Chris, there are people that are leaders in effective field goal percentage that don't show up as high up in, say, field goal percentage. Some of the examples, and you can kind of point out the obvious connection between these people are Kevin Martin, J.J. Redick, you know, guys like that. So explain to me why that's important.
Well, players have kind of unique styles of how they play. So players that get fouled a lot, hit fouls at a high rate, or that's in the case of a true shooting percentage, or players that take a lot of three-pointers and hit them at a high rate, in the case of effective field goal percentage are really given more credit under these new statistics than the previous old-fashioned method of calculating field goal percentage. Even a guy that we talked about today, Monte Ellis, he's really helped by a true shooting percentage. He's a guard that scores a lot around the basket, gets fouled a lot, and takes a lot of free throws.
And does he make a lot of them?
He does. He hits a decent clip. He's a little bit like a poor man's Dwayne Wade. And so Dwayne Wade also is another great example. These are both shooting guards that get a lot of their points at the free throw line and are surprisingly poor from deep. By that, I mean they're not bad three-point shooters, but they're not especially good.
Okay. All right. Menzel, you were talking, mentioning before that Kevin Durant is someone for whom this distinction actually makes a pretty big difference. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, so Kevin Durant, kind of as we just discussed, you know, the free throws and three-pointers, Kevin Durant's a very good three-point shooter, a good free-throw shooter, and he goes to the line a lot. I think he led the league in free-throw attempts 2009-2010, and he's led the league in free throws made three of the last 4 years. So when you look at his numbers, you say look back to 2010-2011, you see he was shooting, his field goal percentage was 46%, 46.2. But his effective field goal percentage was 509, that's 40 points higher. And his true shooting percentage was 589, another 80 points higher. You know, so he's the kind of the perfect storm of guys who you'd see a really big difference between their field goal percentage and their true shooting percentage, which kind of anchor either end of this discussion.
And also the thing that the statistic really highlights with Kevin Durant is just how dominantly he good is via offensive efficiency. So he not only scores a lot of points, but he does it in a very efficient way.
So it sounds like in some ways the field goal percentage is still a perfectly fine kind of rough measure. But if you want to capture these kind of special talents and these very efficient players, these more refined tools is the way to go. Is that fair to say?
I think it helps, yeah.
All right. Well, that now folks, including myself, will know a little bit more what we mean when we use those terms. Guys, it's time to assign the homework for next week. I'll always assign myself first, because that way I get first choice.
Real
That's
quick, guys.
That's how it works. This week, I'm going to go with a... I'm sorry?
Yeah, weren't we talking about doing one guy as a group?
Did you ask if you could make a request? How has this worked out for you in the past? Have I ever listened to one of your suggestions?
No.
But go ahead.
But,
yes, I'd love to hear.
Didn't we talk about doing one, all three of us doing the same person this upcoming week?
Yep, we did.
Got to do that, or are we going to go with three and three?
Oh, in that case, I guess I have to pick first then. And the pick's Isaiah Thomas.
I also choose Isaiah Thomas.
Excellent.
I'm excited. You guys read my mind.
We're in agreement. We could do a little, I mean, the idea is, I think we should all do Isaiah Thomas, but maybe kind of cover the rest of the new Seattle Supersonics as well.
I'm down with that.
Maybe not everybody, but, you know, just sort of a heavy context.
All right, so that's our homework, and we are running a little long, so we're going to wrap it up. Guys, would you like to say goodnight to the listeners?
Sleep tight, fans.
Good night, everybody.
And until next week, save us a seat at the next Sonics game. Sorry, Sacramento.
Danilo Gallinari can shoot the three. He's got some mad game. When they lose, Rob thinks that he's to blame. Rebounding vampires are some to admire. Hickson comma, JJ, for what team does he play? Tell me what is wrong with Monte Ellis. Tell me why he has a bad plus minus. Tell me why do his teams play like an anus? Wow, Rob, what did you just say? There's a dude named Clay, plays for Golden State. He likes to shoot the three, and Scott says that he plays good D. Tell me why no one can now defer. True shooting number one is Tyson Chandler. Go tell your friends what you learned at the Teardrop Runners. Peace out next week. It's IT. Boom.
Whoa.
Wow. That was amazing.
Good night, everybody.
Rob.
Drop the mic.
Holy shit. That was cool.